are building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign.
Greetings, everybody, and welcome to Peace Paradigm Radio, radio that explores the active power of nonviolence in our world today through conversations with practitioners and scholars and everyone in between. So I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Negler, and today's Friday, October 14th, 2016. On our previous show, we celebrated the life of Mahatma Gandhi. It was his 147th birthday celebration on October 2nd. And we spoke with Veena Howard, who wrote a book called Gandhi's Ascetic Activism, Gandhi's Nonviolence and His Renunciation. And it was about this, specifically his experiments in brahmacharya, one of the most misunderstood elements of Gandhi's background, and it brings up a lot of contention and a lot of confusion when people try to understand who Gandhi was and then what were these experiments that he was conducting throughout his life, specifically in terms of celibacy. But today we want to continue the conversation about Gandhi, and we have on the phone with us Mike Heller, who is the co-coordinator of the Peace and Justice Studies program at Roanoke College in Virginia. He's a professor of English with an emphasis in American literature, but he co-edited a book called Mohandas K. Gandhi, The Last 18 Years, a Nonviolence and Social Change Source Book. So we want to welcome Mike Heller to our show today. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Stephanie, and hi, Michael.
Hi.
So, Mike, tell us a little bit about your own background. What brought you into the field of peace and justice studies? I think this is a very, you have quite an interesting story to tell, so I want to let you tell our listeners.
Well, I am a graduate of West Point, and I spent 5 years in the Army. And at the end of that time, I was very unhappy in the Army, and I found my way to a Quaker meeting. And not long after I got out of the Army, I became a Quaker. I was in my late 20s. And actually, if I go back, just go back a little bit further, I grew up in a military environment. My father was a career military person and lived on military bases. And my older brother had gone to West Point. So it's sort of a path that was in front of me. But I was very confused as an 18-year-old, and the Vietnam War was raging. So anyway, I went to West Point, and when I graduated, I went on to Ranger School and Airborne School, and I tried to make the best of it, but I was very conflicted even while I was at West Point and while I was in the Army at the same time that I was trying to make it work. So I was a very confused young man.
Mike, if I could weigh in here just a second, I'm sure you know as well as I do, if not better, that your story is not alone. That our society kind of funnels people into that kind of career and gives them all kinds of support and praise for pursuing it, but it doesn't really touch the deep psychological problems that more sensitive people will have. And if you think in terms of our friend Rachel McNair, who is developed a concept called perpetration-induced traumatic stress. We herd people into traumatizing situations that are traumatic for themselves more than even for the people whom they injure. And so you did a very courageous thing, and I want to say it puts you in a position of advantage, because nobody could accuse you of, you know, being a pacifist and not knowing about the other side and not having courage.
Yeah, thank you. I do feel like I've got some understanding of the military, and I have a lot of respect for many military people, and also kind of a compassion and sympathy because of my own experience. If I can use a bad word on the radio, I was kind of a dumbass, I think, as an 18-year-old, and even as a 22-year-old going into the Army. And I think I can thank the military, actually, for kind of pushing me in this direction. And so I became a Quaker, and at the same time, I wanted to become a teacher after I was in the military, and I went back to graduate school and studied literature and teaching English. Became a high school teacher for 7 years in Arizona, and then went back to graduate school again and got a PhD in literature and ended up moving to Virginia. So I've been in Virginia now for a long time, almost 30 years teaching, and all that time being active in a Quaker meeting and working on teaching peace studies, peace and justice studies.
Mm-hmm. Mike Heller, he's co-coordinator of the Peace and Justice Program at Roanoke College, and he co-edited a book with the Olmsteds called Mohandas K. Gandhi, The Last 18 Years. You're getting us situated a bit with your own background of having studied the mechanisms of war making at West Point, growing up in a military family. And you said at some point in that process, you were feeling conflicted and then ended up finding the Quakers. What did the Quakers have to do with nonviolence? Can you talk a little bit there about, for our listeners, about what, how the Quakers helped you to get loose from the mindset that had been indoctrinated into you since as a young person?
Yeah. Well, first, I didn't know anything about the Quakers except, you know, vaguely having heard about them. And I was in the Army, and I remember my wife and I had gone to see a play in the community in El Paso, Texas. I was stationed at Fort Bliss, Texas then, and was a lieutenant. And after the play, in the lobby, there was some literature set out on a table, pamphlets, and there was one for the Quakers in El Paso, Texas, and I picked it up and looked at it. That was kind of, you know, nothing happened, but it was a little catch point. And then late in my Army time, towards the end of my 5 years, a friend of my wife's took her to the Sandy Spring Quaker meeting in Maryland, and she came back, and my wife said to me, I think that you might like this. And so a couple weeks later, we went. And what drew me to the Quakers first was the silent worship. I actually wasn't thinking about nonviolence very directly at all, although I knew that they stood for nonviolence. So I gradually learned about it by continuing from then on with Quakers and learned more, and it kept challenging me. I would say it's just been a continual life journey of learning. Let's see, I could give you a little more background.
Well, let's jump into from that perspective of that looking inward, and that the Friends Society helped you to discover Gandhi. As let's get to your book, Mohandas K. Gandhi, The Last 18 Years, that you co-edited with Sterling Olmsted and Ruth Olmsted. Tell us a little bit about what this book does and what it is. It's a resource, a nonviolence and social change source book. Let our listeners know what they might expect in this book.
Sure. we Sterling Olmsted and I got started on what we hoped would be a series of source books that could be used by churches, Quaker meetings, and college classes, high school classes. And the first book we did was on John Woolman, the early American, colonial American Quaker who fought against slavery. And then we went on to do the book on Gandhi. And we wanted to include selections in Gandhi's own words. So people could go to this and encounter Gandhi's thinking. And like it says in the subtitle, use it as a resource for social change.
Absolutely. And Mike Heller, you are the co-coordinator of the Peace and Justice Program at Roanoke College in Virginia. This source book is, I think it's very interesting because as the director of the Meta Center for Nonviolence, where we have a strong emphasis on the writings and life and philosophy and the application of the philosophy of Mahatma Gandhi, people come to us and say, well, where do you recommend that I begin? They've read about Gandhi through other writers. So how do you direct people to his own words when he's written there's volumes and volumes and volumes of his speeches and writings, and they change over time. So this book focuses on the last 18 years of his life and campaign. So can you situate us within those 18 years and tell us why you focused there instead of earlier in his life or later?
Yeah. One of the great ways to start studying Gandhi is to read his autobiography. Mm-hmm. And that's often what happens in my classes. I have students read the autobiography. And as Sterling Olmsted and I worked on this book, we realized that we wanted it to be a limited book in its length. We didn't want to have a giant book of selections from Gandhi. And it evolved that we thought it would be useful to have a book to follow the autobiography or to build on the autobiography. Gandhi wrote the autobiography in small chapters that were published weekly in 1927 and 1929, well, between those years. And he stopped writing the book right around 1920. I mean, he stopped in 1929, but the story only goes up to about 1921 and 1922. And as I taught the book, people would ask me, well, what about the rest of the story? He goes on to live till January of 1948 when he's assassinated. Well, we decided to start the rest of the story with the Salt March. The 1920s would have been interesting to cover. Most of the 1920s come after what's in the autobiography. But for length purposes, we decided not to cover that. He was in jail early in the 1920s and had been sentenced to 6 years in jail, but was let out early because of appendicitis. The British didn't want him to die in jail. They wouldn't have been able to handle the response to that. And I think he kind of retreated in the 1920s to think about his next steps and what he could do. And he wrote the autobiography, and he wrote another book, Satyagraha in South Africa, which is really an excellent book, too, talking about his methods that he developed over time.
And there's actually a very interesting film that follows Satyagraha in South Africa called The Making of the Mahatma that people can probably find online at YouTube and other places to really get a sense of what Gandhi was going through in South Africa, that he spent an entire lifetime, an entire career, you could say, in South Africa. And then he still goes to India to continue the work, which is really inspiring for anybody who feels slightly overwhelmed with what the world is offering today, that that Gandhi could have ended his career in South Africa and left, but he decided to come back to India and keep the movement growing. I think that it's really interesting, Mike Heller, that you do focus on the last 18 years. Only if because the spiritual guidebook for Mahatma Gandhi was the Bhagavad Gita. And in particular, his favorite verses were the last 18 verses of chapter 2 of the Gita, which is about the man or woman or human being who lives in wisdom. And this is really a part of the Gita that begins to show that this isn't about a real war. This isn't about a war in the outside world. This is about an inner war, which is just as real, rather, if not more real than the war in the outer world. Mike Heller, at the end of this book, you have really interesting questions that are for, you call them questions to consider. And I thought here on Peace Paradigm Radio, we're very interested in Gandhi. You wrote the book about this. You brought together his writings. What if we played a little game where we ask each other some questions from this guidebook and talk them over for our listeners?
Great. I like that.
All right. So I'm going to take you off the hook for a second, and I'm going to turn it over to Michael, and I'm going to start with you, Michael, for your first question from Questions to Consider. And so folks who get this book can also do this with their friends and family after reading it, or at least we know what they might get out of the book. So Michael Nagler, The Salt March. The Salt March may have been Gandhi's greatest satyagraha campaign. What contributed to its success? In a few words.
Stephanie, it's going to be hard to answer that in a few words.
Okay. Well, take what you need.
I'll say what I can. It was what we call a nonviolent moment. That is, the forces of repression had built up to exactly what they were. The gloves had come off. Some people think that the American presidential campaign has had a similar effect. And on the other hand, the nonviolence that he had been training people in for 15 years, to speak of the Indian phase, was also becoming mature and ready to be employed. And then he picked one of the most perfect issues, which symbolizes colonialism itself. I hope you'll agree with me, Mike, that he, when you come into a country and take away their resources and sell it back to them, that's how colonialism worked. And I remember in your book, one of the quotations, Gandhi is in Lancashire, I believe, the year after the campaign, and he says that this is the best, because of the fact that we waged this struggle through nonviolence, it is a help to the whole world. So one of the ways that it was a help to the whole world was it was such an icon, such a poster child for colonialism. And what Gandhi did was break that system.
Can I add to that, Michael?
Of course.
So using this source book as a reference, I turn to page 30, which is a letter to Lord Irwin, and it's written from the Satyagraha Ashram in Sabarmati on March 2nd, 1930. And what I learned from looking into this letter is that Gandhi used the SALT campaign as an educational opportunity to develop the method that he was going to be using with people, not only what he did in South Africa, but here's applying it in India. And he starts off with his values and his principles. And he said, "I must not be misunderstood. Though I hold the British rule in India to be a curse, I do not, therefore, consider Englishmen in general to be worse than any other people on earth. I have the privilege of claiming many Englishmen as dearest friends. Indeed, much that I have learned of the evil of British rule is due to the writings of frank and courageous Englishmen who have not hesitated to tell the truth about that rule." So he begins the campaign by saying, "This is my duty to, as a civil resistor, to let you know this is going to happen and maybe we can find a way out. And I'm against the rule. I'm not against you as people." So that's the beginning of this educational campaign. And then at the end of this letter, he says, "This letter is not in any way intended as a threat, but is a simple and sacred duty of the civil resistor. Therefore, I am having it specially delivered by a young English friend who believes in the Indian cause and is a full believer in nonviolence." And he signs it, "I remain your sincere friend." So what do you have to say about that, Nagler?
Several things. One is this clear distinction that he never lost between the evil done by people and the people themselves. You know, in a film that we're making now, we quote Barbara Deming, who said that nonviolence has two hands. The one is I will not cooperate with your injustice. And the other is, but I am open to you as a human being. Mm-hmm. That's what makes nonviolence different, mm-hmm. that you are never against persons, including your own person. There's another interesting issue that came up, and maybe Mike will comment on this also. When he says that the letter is not meant as a threat, well, that's a subtle but crucial difference. In nonviolence is not an example of what Kenneth Boulding called threat power. You do have to say to people, look, if you're not going to stop with this particular injustice, we will be forced to do the following. And Gandhi was in that position several times. That if you do not relieve us of this burden, we are going to have to take civil disobedience up again. But in a subtle way, it wasn't meant as a threat. And I myself find it a little bit hard to really pinpoint the difference, but I feel that there is a crucial difference there. In threat power, you're saying, I'm going to do something that you don't like if you don't do something that I like. And in nonviolence, you're saying, I'm going to resist something bad that you're doing in order to bring us closer.
Very interesting, Michael. I want to turn now to you, Mike Heller, co-coordinator of the Peace and Justice Program at Roanoke College in Virginia. As a Quaker, in 1931, Gandhi then spoke with friends in England. What impresses you about this letter that we can find in this book?
Well, before we look at that, you mean the letter to Lord Irwin?
Oh, well, I was thinking about the speech at Friend's House in particular that he gives.
Well, before we go to that, sure. I'd like to put in my 2 cents about the Salt March.
Okay.
One of the things that made the Salt March as successful as it was is that Gandhi was a genius for locating symbols or creating acts that became symbolic, and spoke to millions and millions of people. And his decision to create this Salt March did that. It was symbolic of their whole need for independence and their struggle with the British. And it spoke to millions of people who at that time were illiterate and across the whole nation. The other thing I find so fascinating about this letter to Lord Irwin is that Gandhi is demonstrating a kind of textbook example of how to do this. He has no secrets. He's being totally upfront with the Viceroy of India, and he's saying, here's what we're going to do. And I hope that you respond before we do that, and we change these laws. And in fact, Gandhi's asking him for a response. And if there's no response, then he's going to go on with the Salt March. And if there's still no response, Gandhi's going to do something else. His goal is to provoke a response.
And in a way that's interesting, that takes into account the humanity of his opponent and in a way assumes the best about them, that I know this is who you are really, and I know you want to respond to this, and I'm challenging you to respond to this. And I think that that's something that if we focus in on that, we can begin to deepen our practice of social change through that kind of assuming the best in others and knowing that there's other things in the way. But if we reach their humanity first, we can work out the other details in ways that are mutually satisfactory.
Yeah, he wants the British to be his friends, and he's not going to sacrifice that friendship. So when they leave India, they'll still be friends.
Hmm.
Or he's converting his opponents to friends. In the words of the New Testament, he's converting his enemies to be friends.
You know what that reminds me of, Mike? That's a very good point. There's a quote from Arnold Toynbee, the British historian, about Gandhi, where Toynbee says, he made it impossible for us to go on ruling India, but he made it possible for us to leave without rancor and without humiliation. Now that's such an important. Powerful. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's very powerful.
Yeah.
Now I want to point out that then after the Salt March and Gandhi's imprisonment, and then he is invited to the second roundtable conference, and this is when he speaks to the Quakers, and there's a letter from Friend's House from September 12th, 1931 in London, and he talks to them about the two schools of social change being violence and nonviolence, and he says, I know that there is a school of violence in our midst, and he says this, he says, I know many of these young men. I have lived with them. I have mixed with them. I have talked to them also. I have endeavored, as several others of their co-workers have endeavored, to win them from what we hold as an error. But at the same time, I know there is a common cause even between them and ourselves. They are burning to attain the freedom to which India is entitled, which is India's birthright. So, again, you have him speaking very frankly about what his common cause is with people. And what he's really working on is to try to reach people in his own fold, as well as those on the outside, to adopt nonviolent means, because that's the way the conversation can really go deeper. What impressed you about this letter at Friend's House as a Quaker?
Well, I liked very much that he's saying he has a good understanding of the school of violence, and he's in communication with people, friends who are in that school, and that's something I identify with. And I'm actually, as a Quaker, proud of the fact that he had so much of a connection with the Quakers and interacted with them a lot when he was in London for the second roundtable conference. That many of them were hosting him while he was there. I want to say something about the next paragraph of the letter.
Mm-hmm.
The next paragraph begins, "We may be nationalists, we may be ardent patriots, but immediately we apply these means of truth and nonviolence. Our patriotism becomes internationalism. Our patriotism is so conceived that we want our freedom not to injure the freedom of any other country or any single individual." This really struck me as I was thinking about things going on in our country today. Gandhi's conceiving of a patriotism that's nonviolent. And in our country, I find it perplexing that our U.S. flag as a symbol is conflated with honoring our military. So when Colin Kaepernick takes the knee during a singing of the national anthem at a football game, people are deeply offended, and they take it as a insult to our military, which I think is really questionable and problematic, and I struggle with that.
Yeah, you know, I saw a recent New Yorker cartoon that had two people, one being the gentleman you just mentioned and another gentleman I won't name, both of them saying America's not great, one of them getting cheers and the other one getting hatred. So
yeah,
let's take a quick break. Mike Heller. And we're talking with Mike Heller, co-coordinator of the Peace and Justice Studies program at Roanoke College, about his book that he co-edited with the Olmsteds, Mohandas K. Gandhi, The Last 18 Years. So stay tuned and we'll be right back. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with Michael Negler. And we are continuing our deepening of Gandhi's life from his 147th birthday, which was on October second, and we had a nice conversation with Vina Howard on our last show, author of Gandhi's Ascetic Activism, Renunciation and Social Change. And we're talking with Mike Heller, co-coordinator of the Peace and Justice Studies program at Roanoke College in Virginia, on a book that he co-edited called Mohandas K. Gandhi, The Last 18 Years, A Nonviolence and Social Change Source Book. And before the break, we were talking about Gandhi's internationalism and the way that his patriotism meant freedom for everybody, not just for Indians, but that the minute that his patriotism begins to get in the way of somebody else's freedoms, it can't be called by that name. And we were discussing some of the more contemporary examples of how that has become even more problematic today. So welcome back to the show, Mike Heller.
Thank you, Stephanie.
So as we were going through in the source book questions, which was sort of fun to do if you have friends that want to study Gandhi together and you want to go directly to Gandhi's words, you can use this book and then test yourself a bit on what you're learning about this very interesting last 18 years of his life. And so I'm going to just jump into another question, Mike. How do you feel about that?
Sure.
Okay. So let's see. How about number 10? What can we take from Gandhi's writings about violence and nonviolence? Would you call him idealistic or realistic? And are idealism and realism antithetical? Would you like to start us off on that one?
Sure.
Okay.
Actually, this gives me an inroad to say something else. I want to say something about Sterling and Ruth Olmsted. Sterling Olmsted was a mentor to me, and he and I worked on this book together for a long time, and he was getting old, and I was very busy with my work teaching, and we were having a hard time finishing the book. I became the department chair, and I was, you know, just overly busy, and the book manuscript kind of sat on the shelf for a while. And I asked Ruth Olmsted, who is Sterling's daughter, if she could step in and help. And she and I were able to wrap the book up and get it published. And it came out in 2011, the year that Sterling, her father, died. And he was 96 years old and a great admirer of Gandhi and really educated me and got me started on Gandhi. Well, that gets to the question. Sterling loved to refer to Gandhi as a practical idealist. And I remember something I heard from a Quaker in Arizona. Her name is Ann Hart. She said that sometimes we think that idealism and practicality are opposed to each other. But sometimes the idealistic path is the most practical path. I think Gandhi saw that.
I want to bring up Michael Nagler, who has a lot of thoughts on this as well. Michael, what do you think? Was Gandhi's idealism in the way of his realism? And what do you think about this idea of practical idealism?
To have a distinction between the two, I mm-hmm. completely agree with Mike. It's an artifact of our modern civilization where we're constantly doing either-or mm-hmm. thinking. And the only thing you need to do to see that that's not true is to give it a slightly longer time frame. That is, in the long run, the moral thing to do will turn out to have been the most practical thing. It's only in the very, very short term that sometimes it seems like you can punch your way to a solution, but that what you've actually punched your way through to is a new problem. So that was one of Gandhi's most brilliant discoveries, I think, Mike. I completely agree with you, and that is a good note to end on, which we unfortunately have to do now. Let me just say, by way of closing, that I loved your book when it came out in 2011, and I still think it's a wonderful source book for the career of this person who was, I believe, and we believe here at Meta, to be probably the prophet and one of the most important human beings of the 20th century. So thanks.
So that's a bit of practical idealism there for you. That's quite
right,
an idealistic
statement. Right there. I just illustrated it. So
thanks so much, Mike Heller from Roanoke College, for joining us today to talk about your book, Mohandas K. Gandhi, The Last 18 Years in Nonviolence and Social Change Sourcebook, which people can find online or ask their bookstores to order it. And if you're teaching any classes on social change and you want to bring in Mohandas K. Gandhi's writings, then this would be a good one to draw from, I think. Mike, and we hope to have you back again to talk about John Woolman another time.
Oh, I'd love that. Well, I think it's a really good book also for church groups who might like to talk about Gandhi and, you know, learn about Gandhi. Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Mike. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So let's turn now to some nonviolence in the news. For several shows, we haven't gotten to this segment, and there's a lot happening in the world, from the Dakota Pipeline to Black Lives Matter to nonviolent cities. So Michael Negler, take us away.
Thanks so much, Stephanie. Yes, you're certainly right. It's a dilemma. There is so much going on. As usual, I'd like to mention a few resources and then get into the news and then close with a couple of important events that are coming up. So there is a Peace Science Digest online now, an online journal, which is on peace education. And its mission is, quote, a complete paradigm shift in education. Wouldn't that be desirable? And behind it is the War Prevention Initiative, an organization that's been going on for a long time. So Peace Science Digest should be able to come right up on the web for you. Now, speaking of war prevention, which is a topic that's gathering momentum right now, there is a new edition of a resource which I may have failed to mention before. It's called A Global Security System, An Alternative to War. So that new edition, the 2016 edition, is now available online or through Ingram, which is also where you can get Stephanie's book, Gandhi Searches for Truth, A Practical Biography for Children. And they put some major conference videos online, or one big major conference was held in the capital area, the D.C. area, with a lot of speakers who are well-known in this field, and you can find it online. While we're in that part of the world, the United States Institute for Peace, based in Washington, D.C., and with this 100-year process to get it established, has two online courses. One is called 100 Years of Quaker Peace Building. That one is free. And the other is called Civil Resistance and the Dynamics of Nonviolent Movements. A very hot topic these days, thanks to Erica Chenoweth, Maria Stefan, and many others. That one there's a slight charge for. And I'm happy to say, because this is a pervasive interest here with us, it's an interest in nonviolent peace force and in Peace Brigades International and groups like that who do unarmed civilian peacekeeping. I'll have more to say about that when we get to Standing Rock. But the Portland Peace Team is now creating training videos in conjunction with other groups. And this is something that we've wanted to see for a long time here at META, so that if a community wants to start a peace army or a peace intervention service of some kind, there will be resources available based on the experiences of people who have done this work domestically or internationally now for over 20 years. So one more resource before we go on to the news comes from War Resisters International, based in London. They are raising funds to develop a new website, which is very similar to what we were just talking about. The website will be called the Nonviolent Resistance Manual. So it will complement my book, The Nonviolence Handbook, which deals with the theory and how to analyze the dynamics of nonviolent movements and campaigns. This gives you how to organize and what strategies and tactics can be applied. The two should go very well together. They're going to incorporate the knowledge of activists from around the world and cover a wide range of issues, which nonviolence can do. And this manual will help us share ideas, tactics, and strategies to make campaigns more effective and sustainable. Wouldn't that be a plus? So now moving on to the news, yes, let's start with Standing Rock. Things have gotten intense. There is great determination on the part of the protectors of the water. That's what they call themselves. They're saying water is life. And unfortunately and ironically, the government issued lifted the injunction on the digging of the pipeline through their area in the what the native people call sacred stone. And they did this on Indigenous Peoples Day, ironically enough. Of course, still calling it Columbus Birthday. The protesters, or protectors, as they accurately call themselves, are continuing to pursue legal avenues, which is a very good thing to do in this kind of campaign. They're asking all of us to call or email the White House and ask the president to stop the digging on the sacred sites. They're saying history is repeating itself. And by and large, I think this is an excellent campaign that's being well run. It draws very deeply on Indigenous resources, namely prayer and ceremony. And they have repeatedly stated that they're not against any of the people in the company doing the digging. I do have to say, though, this is where we do our analysis part, there is a somewhat disturbing element for me. And that is in the pictures of people with raised fists and bandanas, which seems to me like a kind of militancy, which is only going to provoke the already serious oppression and resistance from the other side. And I think it's completely unnecessary and changes the vibration. Senator Bernie Sanders, of whom I think you have heard, along with many others, Dianne Feinstein, etc., have written the president asking him to halt the pipeline until the Army Corps of Engineers does a full environmental impact study. One of the protectors says, if there is one profound lesson that Indigenous people, I'm sorry, this is one of, not one of the protectors, an onlooker. If there is one profound lesson that Indigenous people have taught us, it is that all of us as human beings are part of nature. We will not survive if we continue to destroy nature. And they point out that 17 million people will be affected if there's a spill on that pipeline. Go ahead, Stephanie, and then I'll wrap up on this topic.
Well, I just want to point out for our listeners the way that media plays a role in helping to support nonviolence in our world, and that part of the problem of the wars that we see all over the world that are perpetuated by our own government's involvement and our Department of Defense and so forth is that we don't learn about the nonviolent movements as readily as we learn about violent factions taking off, and then we say, what can we do about them? And we focus on that. So there's a real shift taking place when you can hear on community radio, on podcasts, on social media about nonviolent movements taking place in the world. So right now, those of you who are hearing about this are actually participating in the movement in that way, because it's against the interest, in a way, for the violent system for us to know about those who are actually coming up against it and who need support. So,
very good observation, Stephanie, and I think one of the most powerful things to dislodge the present system or get rid of its abuses is the knowledge of an alternative, and that's exactly what we're trying to do here. What you probably will not find anywhere in the mainstream media is analysis that can give you a good window on how to understand the dynamics of what's happening and why it is that some movements are more successful than others. So for very good updates on the Dakota Access Pipeline issue, I'd refer you to Censored News. Censored News on the web has a lot of stories and videos. Now, I'm happy to say that next week, and this is something that we at Meta have helped to facilitate, next week an exploratory team is going to Standing Rock from the Nonviolent Peace Force. And that could really, really elevate consciousness in the way that you were just talking about, Stephanie, when this is, you know, an activity that's been going on. Michigan peace teams, META peace teams, etc., all around Turtle Island, you know, all around our hemisphere, on our continent. But I think this one could get more publicity. They seem to be doing it right. The stated purpose of this team is, quote, "The purpose of the Nonviolent Peace Force visit will be to conduct, to learn more about the situation, to present to the community about Nonviolent Peace Force's work, and to assess whether or not NP's programming is wanted and could be effective in this context." And they're doing exactly the right thing, as they always do, by contacting people in the community. They're not, like, parachuting in, saying, we have the solution. They're being very sensitive and very careful, and we have helped them with some contacts on the ground there. Well, enough about the United States of America and its problems. Turning just for a second to a follow-up with the women's boat to Gaza. It was one boat in the end, because one of them was or was not sabotaged, but it couldn't get it get very far from port. And the boat that went, the Zaytuna Olivia, was in fact hijacked in international waters by the Israeli military a couple of weeks ago. All the women on board were taken in detention to the port of Ashdod in Israel, but they have now been released. And they pointed out, collective punishment, which is what the blockade of Gaza is. It's punishing every man, woman, and child in Gaza, whether they shoot rockets or not. Collective punishment is illegal under international law and in the Geneva Convention. Spokeswoman said, "These women know that they may be in danger at some point, but their sense of justice and their consciences as human beings are such that they cannot risk doing nothing." So women from 13 countries and 5 continents were on that boat, and we'll see what the publicity is and what the upshot may be. Stephanie.
It's interesting rhetoric, too, to pay attention to. They cannot take the risk of doing nothing versus taking the risk of getting arrested or possibly killed on that boat. So which risk is worth more?
That is a very good observation, because when we're addressing the possibility of getting involved in something, we often say to ourselves, oh, but it's risky. Mm-hmm. But we forget to put into the equation the risk of doing nothing and letting the situation get worse. Mm-hmm. So, yes, that was a very good observation that they made.
And for everybody, it will be different. Some people will be called to be on that boat. Other people will be called to make media about it. Other people will be called in other ways to talk to their neighbors, to create the culture that makes collective punishment impossible and so forth, that we all are working on it in different ways. And that's really important to notice, that unity and diversity that pervades our nonviolence and who we are.
That is a very good setup for our final event announcement that I'm going to get around to in a little bit. So let me leave you with that cliffhanger and give a couple more news items, going abroad and then coming back to the U.S. This is not brand new, but a couple of months ago, there was a major nonviolent uprising in Baghdad. And we were very happy to report on it, because we had found out that my book, The Nonviolence Handbook, in Arabic translation, had been actually used, been read by all the leaders of that very daring insurrection, where they literally broke into the green zone, tearing down concrete walls through nonviolent action. That's a gray area there, but I guess you could call that nonviolent action. And they saw water flowing in the irrigation system, electricity available all day and night, and became profoundly aware of the inequality and the injustice of this reality. More recently, when you go to talk, and if you can talk freely with Iraqis of Shia, Sunni, Kurdish descent, or Palestinians, Christians, Yazidis, international and many other backgrounds, talk to them about it, equality, civil and human rights, solidarity, unemployment, and freedom. Anyone visiting Baghdad at that time could not have missed the great energy of nearly 3,500 Iraqi activists, young and old, from across the country who came to support the third Iraqi Social Forum, the second running of the Baghdad Marathon for Peace, and the closing ceremony of that forum. Iraqis weren't able to actually get to the forum, but they participate in it in this way. I'm happy to report, coming back now to our country, that the Department of Justice, the DOJ, has bowed to public pressure and their condemnation of inhumane abuses and will stop paying private prison corporations to hold immigrants in detention. If you've ever read the story of George Fox, you will realize how horrible private prisoning can be, and it has been really a nightmare to see it coming back. Well, now I want to talk about a few events, and in particular, one I'm very proud of. On November 12th and 13th in the Bay Area, we will be having a strategy conference just along the lines that you were mentioning, Stephanie, bringing together activists from all around the movement into a hopefully a united focus. We consider this to be the first of many events. And you can find out about it by looking at the tikkun.org website. Mm-hmm. That's tikkun.org. And the event is called What Next?
Right after November 12th, so right after the election. So take that energy and harness it into constructive action. Michael, you have 30 seconds for your next events. What do you got?
There's an injustice boycott that's going to start on the same day that the Montgomery boycott did 60 years ago, namely December 5th. And they're illustrating a lot of the nonviolent principles that we've been talking about earlier, namely not wanting to embarrass the opponent and not giving them plenty of time to respond before they move in with the nonviolent resistance. Mm-hmm. So injustice boycott, there's a long URL, but I think injustice boycott could get you there. If not, contact us, info@metacenter.org. Mm-hmm. And that is just a fraction of the nonviolent news, but that is our segment for this show.
Thank you so much, Michael Nagler, my news anchor and co-host here at Peace Paradigm Radio. I want to thank you, all of our listeners, for joining us for another episode, and especially to our mother station who makes KWMR, who makes programs like this possible, to all of our volunteers and staff at the Meta Center for Nonviolence. Thank you very much. To everybody who is learning about nonviolence for the first time or deepening that, thank you very much. And especially to our guest, Mike Heller, from the Peace and Justice Studies program at Roanoke College. Thank you for your work and for being our guest today. And until the next time, everybody, take care of one another. See you soon.